My name is Shannon Ginza, and I will be the coordinator for your meeting. At this time, I would like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Niels Dallaire, President and CEO of Global Health Council, who is calling from the Countdown 2015 Global Roundtable in London.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Niels Dallaire. I'm president of the Global Health Council, and here in London, we're approaching the end of the first of 3 days of meetings called Countdown 2015 Global Roundtable. It's a meeting to bring home the issues of global health, and particularly reproductive health, as laid out at the Cairo International Conference on Population and Development just 10 years ago. You can't have global health without healthy families. You can't have healthy families without healthy women. You can't have healthy women without good sexual and reproductive health. And this is what the program of action that came out of the Cairo International Conference on Population and Development was all about. 10 years later, we've seen some remarkable achievements, and we've seen some troubling roadblocks. And the three speakers addressing you today will be, first of all, Amy Cohen, who is president of Population Action International, a leading organization in research and advocacy on reproductive health and population issues. She was president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Chicago area and now chairs the board of Reproductive Health Technologies Project. Amy Cohen.
You know, I'm head up an organization, Population Action International, that is known for really being a leader in research and policy and advocacy. And when we looked at the 10-year anniversary, the halfway mark of this important 20-year consensus, we started with values. What values are most recognized in ICPD? And we came up with hope, health, rights, and responsibility. But behind that is the numbers, the indicators, and we had to measure what do we know is working, where, what's not, and why not. I hope that all of you out there are looking at our report card. It comes in the middle of a great magazine that we hope you'll use as a resource, as we hope the decision makers in the world will use it as a resource the next 5 years. But we came up with 7 indicators that we think best measure ICPD. We ranked 133 countries, which, by the way, represent 95% of the world's population. The progress indicators that we looked at were girls' secondary enrollment rate. Then we looked at the ratio of girls to boys for secondary enrollment. We looked at the percentage of births that were attended by skilled personnel. We looked at infant mortality, contraceptive prevalence, unmet need for family planning, those who want family planning and can't get it, and we looked at adolescent fertility. Let me tell you the kind of the good news in a nutshell. First is that more couples want and are using contraceptives. More girls are in school, and we have a huge increase in women in elected office when we were looking at trying to examine women gender rights and power. The bad news is that we've got all these many more couples using contraceptives, but we still have 123 million couples who want contraceptives and who can't get it. We're very happy that we're looking at all regions of the world where more girls are in school. And remember that every year a girl stays in school, her chances decrease from being a teenage mom. Her chances decrease that she will live in poverty. However, here's the bad news. Teenage pregnancy remains very, very high. And, of course, leading the developed world is the United States and the United Kingdoms. Maternal mortality is still unacceptably high. A woman dies every minute from a pregnancy-related cause, and most of them are not necessary. Unsafe abortion remains a major public health issue, and of course you all know that HIV/AIDS remains a leading killer. We also are falling far short on supplies. There is not adequate funding, there is not adequate coordination, and there are just too many stockouts. And that's at a time when, for the first time in history, half of the world's population is under 25. I'm going to leave with just one note, and that is, there's one thing to remember is that when women have opportunity, it changes everything.
Second speaker will be Thora Ahmed Obaid, who is the executive director of UNFPA, the United Nations Population Fund, and is also a UN undersecretary. After earning her PhD in cultural anthropology and English literature, Ms. Obaid set up the first women's development program in Western Asia, becoming chief of the Social Development and Population Division of the Economic and Social Commission of Western Asia, and later deputy executive secretary of the commission, and I would note the first senior Saudi Arabian woman to hold this rank at the United Nations. Soraya?
Thank you. The meeting here is very important because it is the voice of the civil society, women groups, youth groups, and so on, in terms of looking at what has been accomplished after this agreement that took place in 1994 at the International Conference on Population and Development. And the importance of that consensus that was reached by 179 countries in Cairo is the fact that they have changed the dialogue and the development paradigm, a new development paradigm, from talking about numbers of people on this earth, to the rights of people to access reproductive health and to have reproductive rights. It also placed the issue of women and the rights of women very high on the agenda. And this was a great major step forward. Since then, 10 years have taken place. There is quite a bit of progress that we can talk about later, but also there are challenges. What's important is that the agenda that was adopted in Cairo, which is the program of action, is really a visionary one because it is an introduction or it's a basis for what later came to be adopted in the Millennium Summit at the United Nations General Assembly and what came to be called the Millennium Development Goals. And there are 8 goals. Poverty is certainly a central piece of these goals, but also maternal health, HIV/AIDS, education, and so on are very important goals that link closely with the agenda that was adopted in Cairo by consensus. And now the voices of the civil society are meeting here to review what happened, and their role will be to focus on what has been achieved in their countries and how can the agenda move even further to ensure not only the rights of women, but the rights of young people to access services and information.
We will end with Tim Wirth. Timothy Wirth is president of the United Nations Foundation and the Better World Fund. Previously, he was a United States Senator and United States Representative from Colorado, as well as the Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs. Mr. Wirth played a major role and led the delegation in negotiating the Cairo Consensus in 1994.
Yes, this is Tim Wirth calling. I had the privilege of helping to organize the U.S. delegation in Cairo 10 years ago and have been engaged in the follow-up since. Cairo was, as Dr. Obaid pointed out, a truly remarkable coming together of nations around the world, really focusing on the issue of engaging women, empowering women, women's rights, the ability of women to influence healthcare systems and the importance of healthcare systems to adapt, in particular, to the rights and needs of women. The result of this truly revolutionary document in 1994 has been very impressive in terms of numbers on child mortality, infant mortality, maternal mortality, the enrollment of girls in school, the empowerment of women. There is a catalog of significant achievements that came out of this important UN conference. There is also, as we enter the second decade after Cairo, a set of new challenges. The AIDS epidemic is a much more dramatic departure than anybody imagined at the time of Cairo 10 years ago. The pandemic is much more severe than anybody thought. There is a significant need to merge the reproductive health and the HIV issues together, focus on a significant prevention strategy, bring those two constituencies more closely together. There's also, since then, been a very interesting change in concerns about demography, coming from simply looking at numbers alone to looking at a much more complicated situation in which aging populations and population decline characterize some parts of the world. Immigration is an increasingly troubling and difficult issue in many, many areas of the world, and in some, population continues to increase sharply. So the demographic world and the demographic challenge has shifted. Third, and maybe most important politically, the role of the United States has changed dramatically from that of being a constructive leader working very closely with friends and allies around the world The United States has joined with countries like Syria and Cuba and others in becoming really an obstructionist in so many ways. The United States has not only attacked, but has tried to destroy the Cairo consensus. The United States has been unsuccessful in doing so. The United States has resisted the set of protection strategies for AIDS and women's reproductive health, bringing into question even such simple issues as the efficacy of condoms. And the U.S. political situation, as it has tried to impact around the world, has not been helpful. This is an historic shift and change from a time when the U.S. was truly a leader to now where the U.S. is operating with a very small group of what are known to be very, very reactionary countries in a strategy that certainly detracts from our historic role of leadership. That change, you know, obviously will be part of the debate this fall, but it's certainly for, I think, everybody here, a very saddening and disappointing phenomenon.
Thank you, Amy Thrye and Tim. We'll now be happy to take questions from the media.
And at this time, I would like to go to Ms. Sharon Brassad of The Plain Dealer.
I recently read that population had been lowered primarily because of increased urbanization and the fact that women were more able to control their families, their family size. Do you think that that's the primary reason for the decrease in population?
Let me start first with Thuraya Obaid and then go to Amy Cohen for that one.
Certainly with education, women are able to make more decisions regarding the number and spacing of their children. And as Amy said, education really opens to them this opportunity to make these decisions. Also, as we said, there is an increase of the availability of family planning and reproductive health services, which means women can access these services and be able to plan their families. And the third factor is the fact that when women work, they also are more aware and therefore they are able to plan for their families. So if you talk about in urban areas, women have lower fertility, yes, it is. And that's one of the success stories of the whole issue of population. It's having women be able to make decisions about their fertility.
I totally agree with Thuraya. I would simply repeat what she said. That's absolutely right. Access to both education services in an urban area is much higher.
Does this mean then that there's no worry of a so-called population bomb, which had been written about couple decades ago?
This is Tim Wirth. Let's look at the numbers. I think it's useful to do that. One, we currently have a population of about 6.4 billion people. Under current projections, if we continue to do everything that we're now doing in terms of family planning programs, women's empowerment and engagement, and so on, if we do all of those things, the world's population will increase from 6 to 9 billion in the next 50 years. That means that there will be 3 billion more people. It's faster growth in terms of numbers than the world has ever seen. Now, most of this population growth is going to occur in the poorest areas of the world. The population of India is going to go from 1 to 1.6 billion people in the next 50 years. Pakistan's population is going to double, as is Nigeria's, as is Ethiopia's. Indonesia's population will go up dramatically. Now, what is this impact of population going to have on the resources needed by those people, on the quality of life of those people, and so on? We don't know. We've never seen that kind of a population explosion. On the other hand, populations are declining in some places pretty significantly, Russia, Japan, some parts of Europe. So the world is a very different place than was projected 20 years ago. But to suggest that there are no population issues left anymore is simply incorrect.
Yeah, let me follow up on that. And to reinforce what Tim said, I think 10 years ago, population could be more of a soundbite or a bumper sticker. And now population is a much more complicated issue. You have to talk about it regionally, as Tim just did, because it is dramatically different in different regions. I think we see great success. We see where it's still growing too fast. We do see an improvement in the last 10 years, say in Africa. Women are having less children than they were, but the fertility rate with more people, you know, Tim just laid it out. So the population question, people who are glib and put it on a bumper sticker are wrong.
Can I add two more main points. We know that where population growth is going to increase between now and 2050 is in the least developed countries that are poor, that have poor health systems, poor education system. They have a failing institutional system, and which means that there will be an increase of population and there will not be services, no health, and where HIV/AIDS also finds its way to destroy societies. This is the first point. But the second point is the fact that almost 50% of the population right now are below the age of 24. That's the largest ever youth generation in human history. And they are either in the reproductive age or will be coming into the reproductive age. And therefore, should they not be able to access family planning services, that will show you the trend. We can go much beyond the 9 billion to 12 billion because there are no services that allows this young generation to be able to plan their lives.
We'll move next to Kathleen Ingley of Arizona Republic.
Thank you. Looking at all the information you have now, what are the most critical, relatively specific lessons learned?
This is Amy Cohen. ICPD is working. I think we now know that when services are available, people use them. And when women are the focus of development, it does indeed change everything, that women invest in themselves and, first of all, in their family. So making a woman, educating her and giving her access to family planning services so she can have the number of children she chooses and that she can support them, starts at the family level but goes right up to the community level, and it changes everything.
I'd like to add to what Amy said, this is Soraya, that also among the lessons that we have learned is that reproductive health is not just a health issue. It is an economic, social, and cultural issue. It is a human rights issue, and the Cairo Agreement confirms that access to reproductive health is a human right that should be made available. Also, that it requires the lessons that we have learned in order to achieve the access of people to enjoy the rights of planning their families, we need to have programs on the ground that not only address health issues, but the education of young people. It has to take all the various sectors to work together to be able to ensure that the Cairo Agreement is really implemented in full.
Tim, do you have anything to add?
I think the other lesson is pretty clearly as well. Leadership of the United States is very important in all of this. When the United States leads and leads constructively, it's the momentum that gets created in the rest of the world is impressive. And when the United States does not lead, then a great deal of time and effort is spent in sort of battling between people rather than using the emerging consensus. And we're in a very troubling position right now.
Let me just add one thing, and that is, as a public health physician, what I've seen over the past decade is that the desire for a smaller family size is now nearly universal. It's up to us to make these essential services equally universal. Let's move to the next question.
We're now moving on to Becca Rothschild of Detroit Free Press.
Good afternoon. I have spoken probably to all of you at some point or another about things like the global gag rule, things like funding for UNFPA. How do you keep this discussion focused so that it doesn't get hijacked by the domestic abortion politics? Do you continue to take it on head on, which, as someone who's been editorializing on the issue for 6 years, I feel like I get nowhere? Or do you focus on, what you guys are talking about is so big, it's hard for people to wrap their arms around. So I think it's easy to focus on just the abortion. How do you guys continue, and how would you like others to continue to advocate for this issue?
You know, we talk about rights, and one of the places the world is starting to wake up on is that women are human and they get human rights, that it's not a separate set of rights, and you've talked to all of us about this too. And we have to stay vigilant on the fact that women, they really deserve rights, and we're just going to keep hammering it, and someday it's going to dawn on people. Abortion is a political issue, and I think that it's going to get clear that people just turn the page on the story. But when we talk about focusing on women and making sure they're educated and that life is complicated and everyone deserves basic services and access to those health services and education services and economic opportunities, they know in their own life that that's true. And when we can start reaching out and making that point that it's not a major investment to make those rights available to everyone. And if we have a different, if we have an administration in the United States that supports that, I think that that's going to start changing things. This world is getting very, very small. And I'll tell you, when you're here as we are at this huge global conference, you realize that the world really is starting to form against the United States, that they're tired of this current, the policies of this current administration, and that we're losing friends and we're losing them fast.
This, Soraya, I'd like to add also that going beyond, you know, what you have asked, how can we have the discussion going beyond the abortion agenda? I think once you look at the figures that exist, because reproductive health is a big, big area, when you look just at maternal mortality, and you try to compare it, and you say in the developed industrialized world, it's one woman in 2,800 die when they're giving birth. In the rest of the developing countries, it's one in 67. But in sub-Sahara Africa, it's one in 16. So the basic requirement that women live and don't die when they're giving birth is a major issue that, you know, funding comes also for saving the lives of these women. When you say that in 2003, 5 million people got infected with HIV, that's a major area also that has to be focused on. So the focus is really on the quality of life of people and guaranteeing their rights, that they can have the services to prevent them from HIV/AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases, and to allow women the right to live and not die when they're doing the most basic thing, which is delivering a new life.
It's Tim Wirth. The basic political fact is if the people who keep saying that this issue is all about abortion say it over and over and over again, they get people to start to believe it. None of us believes that. The issue is a much broader, much more important issue than that. And we're not going to allow the discussion nor the future to be hijacked by a few people who are trying to use the abortion issue to attack family planning, to attack the empowerment of women, and to attack the rights of women to protect themselves and the overall framework of reproductive health.
We'll take our next question from Renee Loth of Boston Globe.
Hi. I'm calling you from the Republican Convention in New York, speaking about hijacking. I have a question for Tim. Could you be a little bit more specific about the charge that the United States is obstructionist? What specifically is our problem? Is it funding only? Is it the gag rule? You know, can you speak a little bit more about what you'd like to see change there?
There are a whole series of barriers the United States is now trying to throw across the tracks of progress. You know, one of those is defunding the UNFPA. A second one is the attack through the global gag rule. The third now is the attack on the efficacy of condoms. I mean, you have the head of the AIDS program in the United States beginning to say the condoms don't work anymore. The fourth is political leadership, which are trying to interfere with discussions and agreements that are made all over the world. I mean, there's a long list of ways in which the United States is no longer a gracious and no longer a progressive leader in the world, but rather teamed up with countries like Syria and other regressive countries, you know, is becoming a force not positive but negative.
And I'll just say what's very clear, this is Amy Cohen at this meeting, is that people are saying over and again that what the message they're hearing outside the United States from this administration is, don't confuse me with the facts.
Okay, thank you.
Next question, please.
Susan Whitney of Deseret Morning News.
Hi, thank you. This question is for everyone. I know there's some countries where abortion is illegal, where women are actually sent to jail if they've been found to be trying to have an abortion. What kinds of things are happening in those countries? Can you make progress in other ways in countries like that?
Yes, you can. This is Amy.
Okay.
That's why we're seeing so many deaths from unsafe abortion, where it's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see is a woman dies every 7 minutes from an illegal, unsafe abortion. The good news on this is that the NGO community of women's organizations and women's rights organizations, they're putting their foot down and seeing that this women dying needlessly from, because most of these countries where abortion is illegal, it's also very difficult to get contraceptives. So there is a real civil society movement happening where NGOs are changing policy and laws. And that is the most heartening thing happening. It's, of course, not happening as fast as we would like, but it is indeed happening. And I think that one of the things we're looking at here at 10 Years of Cairo is that the civil society cooperation between the UN, between NGOs, between governments is really about relieving poverty, and that's about focusing on women, and that's about access, and that's about safe abortion.
Any other comments on that?
Well, we also, the agreement in Cairo has pointed out clearly that abortion is not a form of family planning, and that's why it insisted that there has to be universal access to family planning and reproductive health services in order to protect women to plan their pregnancies so that they can not have to go and have abortions. So it's very important to have investment in this right of women for universal access to services. And that's lots of the programs that all we do is to do that. The other one, of course, is we have to show the fact that the deaths resulting from unsafe abortion and the dangers that it does to the health of the woman herself as a public health crisis or issue, as well as to the country itself and to the health system. So it's very important to keep on pointing out all these negative impacts and how they can be taken care of. But most importantly, there has to be a universal access to the reproductive health services.
One of the feelings we're feeling, the strong anti-American feeling here, is the global gag rule is really about restricting contraceptive care. And people outside the United States know more than what seems our policy makers in Washington do, and that is that one in every 10 pregnancies ends in unsafe abortion. In Africa, one out of every 150 abortions lead to death. Listen to this, compared to the rest of the world, the developed world, it's one out of 85,000. Abortions end in death. So you can see, if you are a poor woman in a poor country where your services, like in Kenya, have been cut because of the United States' restrictive policy of the global gag rule, why some of the feelings are running so high here.
There's a small group of really recalcitrant countries, a very, very small group, and it's remarkable that the U.S. is so out of line with almost everybody else in the world.
That's right.
We'll now move on to Margaret McElligott of AllAfrica.com.
Currently, I believe the U.S. is still the largest provider of condoms, and condom provision has actually increased. I believe it's more than doubled in the last 5 years under the Bush administration. How do you square the money that's going to condoms with this perception and what you're seeing as a shift? And do you have any really specific examples of how that's playing out on the ground?
Amy?
You want me to do this one? This is the one that's making us all crazy. We're living in a world where HIV/AIDS is spreading at this incredibly fast rate. We know that education and condoms work, and yet we are underfunding them. When you look at some of the numbers that in sub-Saharan Africa, the funding is for less than 4 condoms a year per man. I mean, Tim just did a great line about do the math and think that through. So the shortfall that we're seeing in condoms and the controversy around condoms is absolutely the wrong conversation to be having. That is so narrow and so focused, and people are so dying and so suffering and dying because of it, that it's mad.
Amy has given the main message.
Okay. Let's move on then to the next question.
We'll take our next question from Frieda Werden of Wings CJFF.
Yeah, this is Frieda Werden from Women's International News Gathering Service and CJSF Campus Community Radio in Burnaby, British Columbia. The question was whether we had seen any change as Canada tries to get itself more in line with the United States.
I think I can answer that,
yes.
Because Canada is a major donor for us.
Oh, good. Okay, they're right.
And they have been very supportive in our executive board with money and so on. So we have not witnessed any change in their support to the Cairo Agreement at all.
Thank you.
This now concludes the audio news conference. You may also visit www.planetwire.org. Have a great day.